A Tale of Two Mine Disasters, The Legal Complications of Cohabitation, An Elite Look at the Elites, Poverty in the Suburbs, Aging and the Economy, Why Latinos Age Differently, and Second Thoughts on Marijuana in California. It's Tuesday, October 19, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Just days after the world celebrated the rescue of 33 miners from the depths of the earth in Chile, there are reports out of China of a mine disaster with at least 20 or more killed in an accident Saturday in an avalanche of coal dust that was triggered by a gas explosion in the central Henan province. Now, what many people have noted is the contrast between the situations in Chile and in China. Theodore Dalrymple, writing in the Wall Street Journal, has remarked on just how the brotherhood of these miners in Chile came out as a great story of the human spirit. But he points out the fact that there's more to it than mere friendship. These 33 miners were sustained by a very explicit reference to their own faith and the fact that they believed that there was transcendent meaning to their lives. Their brotherhood was cemented by a worldview that they shared, and one that was well understood not only by the miners who were in that trapped mine, but also by their family members and others who were watching. Dalrymple writes, "No man is an atheist in the dark, it has been said, but it is unlikely that the religious convictions of the Chilean miners were merely a response to their desperate circumstances. They pre-existed them. The miners were also aided by another factor. While they were isolated in the physical sense, they were far from isolated in any other. For once, media attention was wholly beneficial in its effects. The miners were in the eye of the world. They knew that what they did, how they acted, would be known to untold millions." Dalrymple makes another very interesting moral point here. He suggests that these miners were summoned to a higher moral standard because they knew they were being watched. They knew their story was known. And this form of human peer pressure, he suggests, is an example of how peer pressure can call out virtue as well as vice. He writes, again I quote, "Here then is an illustration of the evident but often forgotten fact that social pressure is conducive to virtue as well as to vice. We generally imagine that so-called peer pressure leads only to such activities as taking drugs and vandalism. But it also leads, or rather can lead, to emulation of virtue, self-respect, and decent pride. No man but an out-and-out psychopath wants to appear worse than his fellows in the eyes of the world." And the miners' justified pride in appearing brave and self-composed helped them to survive their ordeal. End quote. I think Theodore Dalrymple's onto something of importance here, and I think it also shows the contrast between the situation in Chile and the situation in China. The Chilean government immediately took responsibility for the accident and mobilized not only their national resources, but an international effort to save the 33 trapped miners. The president of the country joined the effort himself, and of course, the world saw that he was present to congratulate those coming out of the mine as one of the very first in the receiving line. That made sense given the fact that he had been actively engaged along with his government in the process. The Chilean miners seemed to understand that their government did care about them, as did the larger society. Contrast that with the situation in China. Laurie Burkett, writing also in the Wall Street Journal, points out that there have been many mine disasters, even this year in China. Last year, China reported the world's largest number of mining-related fatalities, and by the way, that is at least 2,631. But in 2002, the mine fatalities were almost 7,000, 6,995. The Chinese government seems to have given its people no assurance that if they are injured or lost or trapped in a mine, that they will be cared for and rescued. And furthermore, it appears that the most basic safety equipment and precautions are often not taken. Now, how can this be read otherwise than a very different valuation of human life? Inevitably, we draw worldview consequences from this because the situation in Chile and the situation in China reflect two different understandings of what it means to value human life, to protect workers, and to pledge towards one another's best interest, rescue, and good in the case of disaster. The Chilean miners knew that someone was coming for them. There seems to be much less hope for miners trapped or injured in similar situations in China. In a most tragic way, we are reminded that worldviews really do matter. Writing in USA Today, Sandra Block reports that cohabitation comes with some legal complications that many couples do not consider. These legal complications are of less interest to me than the moral background to her story. She writes, quote, "Living together outside of marriage, once associated primarily with Hollywood celebrities and libertines, has become so common that if you tell your parents you're moving in with your significant other, they'll probably roll their eyes and ask you to pass the peas." She continues, "The number of opposite-sex couples living together jumped 13% this year to 7.5 million, according to the Census Bureau. Demographers blame the sluggish job market, which has forced many young adults to share living quarters. Broader societal issues are also at work. Researchers estimate that more than half of married couples live together before they get married. Only 38% of Americans believe that unmarried couples living together is bad for society. Half said it doesn't make much difference, according to a Pew Research Center survey." Now, this article also points out that the situation is especially true when it comes to the moral acceptance of cohabitation among younger adults. They suggest that younger adults may view living together as a way to avoid the hassles often associated with marriage and, interestingly enough, with the end of marriage or divorce. Now, Sandra Block's article is very interesting as she tries to address herself to some of the financial and legal complications that can follow the breakup of a cohabitating couple. There are some unmistakable moral issues in this story, although they appear to be of little concern to its author. When Sandra Block begins by pointing out how routine and uneventful cohabitation has now become, she mentions, of course, the fact that parents hardly consider it with any more moral concern than their children. She also suggests that demographers and others argue that cohabitation is basically grounded now in economic realities, or if not the larger project to cohabitation, then at least the resurgence, the jump of 13% in 1 year to 7.5 million cohabitating couples. Now, let me read to you again from her article. She said this, "The sluggish job market has forced many young adults to share living quarters." End quote. Now, that's very interesting. Let's just consider for the moment that this was a very significant economic dislocation. Let's look at the unemployment figures and see that they are at tragic levels of over 10%. But this is hardly an unprecedented economic downturn. As a matter of fact, looking throughout most of human history, where marriage has been the norm without question, most human beings lived under much more dramatically dire economic circumstances than virtually anyone that is being counted by the demographers in this new trend. What we see here is an effort to displace morality with economics, to suggest that economic realities, well, here's the way it was written again, have forced some couples to live together. Now, you look at that and you realize that this is just not making sense. If indeed many of these younger adults are living together, it's because of moral choices they have made. Is an economic reality a part of that? Without question, an economic downturn and unemployment certainly bring dislocation and worse into the lives of many young adults who may find that their decision to marry would be ultimately delayed. But they're not delaying sex, and it turns out they're not delaying living together. Their living together is, indeed, a moral decision, even if they want to ignore its moral dimension. Now, they've been given an economic argument to add to the mix. You can count on them using it. A fascinating story in the New York Times by Paul Sullivan is headlined, "Scrutinizing the Elite, Whether They Like It or Not." It has to do with a meeting at Columbia University, an academic meeting of a group known as the Elites Research Network. Now, this is a fascinating group. It's a group of academics across disciplines. They include economists, political scientists, sociologists, and historians who are looking at the influence and impact of elites in American culture. As one professor suggested, the increasing concentration of wealth has made it the right time to look more closely at the group. Quote, "We have to understand what's going on at the top." This was said by Dorian Warren, an assistant professor of political science at Columbia University. Now, among the interesting things going on here is the recognition that there is an intellectual, cultural, economic, and academic elite. Together, they comprise various elites that have a disproportionate share of the influence in the shape and direction of our culture. Now, what's really interesting about all of this is that the elites, in this case, are being studied by members of the elite. That's right. The Elites Research Network is, after all, housed at Columbia University, one of the Ivy League universities. And one of the issues that was discussed by those who were there to study the elite is the fact that they themselves represent an elite cohort of the population. Now, just consider this. Of all of the researchers gathered here for this meeting, one, that's right, only one did not hold a degree from an Ivy League institution. Not only that, but those who participated in this meeting pointed out that even as the elites have historically tried to retain their own wealth and influence, well, they're trying to do the same. They spoke of their own efforts to privilege their own children to follow in their footsteps to the elite institutions of higher education, and then on to the open doors that those educational pedigrees make available. So here we have an elite studying the elites. The Elites Research Network is of interest to the New York Times because they say it was an unprecedented meeting. It certainly should be of interest to all of us because it's a signal of the fact that the elites find themselves interesting. Well, let's face it, we all do. But when it comes to the morality of this situation, even those who are studying the elite out of a concern for the influence of the elites, writing from the position of elite influence themselves, admit that they too want to perpetuate this kind of influence and opportunity for their own children. Now, I don't know where that's going to take the Elite Research Network, but it's going to be fascinating to find out. Hope Yin of the Associated Press is out with an interesting story that should capture our attention. If you're looking for poor people in America, those who are living beneath the poverty line, where would you look? The first thought would be that you would look in the inner cities. Well, that would make sense. And historically, the inner cities have been where there have been the greatest concentration and largest numbers of impoverished persons in this country. Now, the inner cities still hold the record for the highest poverty rates. But in actual numbers, raw numbers, the suburbs now include more persons living below the poverty level than even the inner cities. As Yin reports, this is a reversal from the year 2000, a 10-year process that has moved the American population of poverty largely from the cities to the suburbs. She cites Scott Allard, a University of Chicago professor, who wrote one of the reports cited in her article, quote, "Millions of Americans at all income levels moved to the suburbs looking for better schools, better jobs, affordable housing, and a sense of security. But in recent years, as incomes have fallen, people had a harder and harder time making ends meet." Now, in the story, there are several facts that are embedded, including that more than half, or 57%, of the 100 largest U.S. metro areas had substantial increases in poverty over the period 2000 to 2010. Now, when we consider the shape of evangelical Christianity in America, it just so happens that that shape is also largely suburban. As a matter of fact, the Protestant shape of American church life since the 1950s has been about as suburban as the larger economic and demographic trends for the rest of the society. We seem to have a basic preconception of what the suburbs are all about. But what we're told now is that where evangelicals are concentrated in terms of residents and churches, even where the megachurches have basically emerged as major factors in the culture and in the scene, well, now poverty is a part of that picture as well. Many of the people who are unemployed are our own neighbors and members of our own churches. This is an opportunity for very redemptive understandings on the part of the church. And now we're looking at the reality of poverty, not just in our inner cities, but in our suburbs. We could step back and say that the American poverty level is certainly higher than that experienced by many in the world, but the reality is that many people around us are suffering a great financial downturn. Many of them are still struggling to find jobs. And as is so often the case in the inner cities, many of the persons who are suffering most greatly at this time are families with young children, and that ought to have our attention. These reports, as summarized by Hope Yin of the Associated Press, are a wake-up call to evangelical Christians of a tremendous opportunity for ministry right in our own midst. When economists refer to sovereign debt, they refer to the debt actually held by governments for their own obligations. The biggest issue of sovereign debt in most Western democracies are the pension programs, Social Security programs, health and other entitlement programs that are promised to citizens. It is no secret that most of these programs are directed toward the last years of our lives. Now, Natasha Singer, writing in the New York Times, suggests that sovereign debt may reach new epidemic proportions because, well, you can figure this out, people are living longer. She writes, "We're already so used to the idea of greater longevity, in fact, that it may seem ho-hum to learn that boys and girls born in 2008 in the United States have life expectancies of 75 and 81, respectively. Now, how do we compare that? Well, Americans born in 1990 had a life expectancy of 3 decades shorter than those boys and girls born in 2008. Now, Natasha Singer's point is the impending crisis of so many persons living longer, of generations staying on the scene and, well, eating up tax dollars as they go along. She writes, quote, "Unless governments enact sweeping changes to age-related public spending, sovereign debt could become unsustainable, rivaling levels seen during cataclysms like the Great Depression and World War II. Now, as it turns out, governments have very few levers to pull in the case of this situation. Persons living longer, well, that's a social and personal good. But governments paying for these bills, well, they're going to have to decide some very difficult policy changes. Make the age of retirement older? Cut back on certain benefits? All these things are very controversial. In the end, Natasha Singer suggests that most governments are going to have to find some combination of carrot and stick, incentives and, well, rather controversial and somewhat difficult changes to existing systems. But let's just consider this. An additional 3 decades of life, 30 years, is nothing to sneeze at. What this particular article and so many others, including the massive reports upon which this article is based, point out is that the loss of the traditional family structure, where family members take care of each other, and especially for the aged, comes at an enormous social cost. When governments seek to be the sole factor meeting that need, well, it comes at a tremendous expense. And as persons live longer, that expense is only going to grow greater. I can't help but tie that article to one by Miriam Jordan in the Wall Street Journal, which is entitled "Latino Aging Stumps Experts." Now, the experts certainly aren't stumped by the fact that Latinos, like all of us, age. No, the surprise comes in the fact that Latinos have a longevity that is greater than almost all other groups represented in American society. And this means that the Latinos even have a longer age and life expectancy than whites. As Miriam Jordan reports, quote, "The life expectancy for Hispanics is nearly 81 years, compared with 78 years for whites and almost 73 for blacks. As a whole, people in the U.S. can expect to live 77.7 years, according to the report from the Centers for Disease Control." One of the fascinating issues raised by this article and research is why Latinos are living longer. Now, many suggestions have been made as to why this is so, but this much is clear, it isn't about economics. No, it probably has to do with something else, quality of life and family life. As this article suggests, one of the advantages that Latinos have over other demographic groups in America is that they tend to live in extended families, where loved ones care for each other. And that certainly makes a magnificent and remarkable difference that all of us should be able to understand. Research has long indicated that persons live longer and live healthier when even just one person regularly observes them, talks with them, loves them, and checks up on them. The idea of an extended family turns out to be a very good idea, not only economically, not only relationally, but even when it comes to living a long life. A recent front-page story in the New York Times indicates that the United States government will not decriminalize marijuana, will not cease prosecution of cases related to the sale, use, and possession of marijuana, even if the state of California passes Proposition 19, if the voters of our most populous state pass this initiative, which would lead to the decriminalization of at least some possession and use of marijuana. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder Jr. indicated that the United States government will continue to prosecute. The state does not have the ability in this case to prevent the federal government from doing its job. Now, this reaches down into the issues of federalism and political science and constitutionality and all the rest. But the reason I raise it today is that this development, along with several others, has led to an interesting phenomenon. When Proposition 18 was first put on the November ballot, many of the most influential media sources, newspapers, commentators, and political leaders put some encouragement behind the idea that Proposition 19 should be accepted, adopted, ratified, and that indeed some level of marijuana possession and use should be decriminalized. But now all of a sudden, some of those very same influencers and media have decided it wasn't such a good idea after all. As some have noted coast to coast, it looks like finally in California, some of the grown-ups have grown up and have awakened to the fact that decriminalizing marijuana is going to come with a tremendous social cost. And at the end of the day, even if the state of California legalizes marijuana, well, the United States government has said that it's not going to play the same game. Sometimes, we might say, an effort to be cool backfires when you start to count the consequences. Just consider some of the minds making quick changes in California. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I'm in Tampa, Florida, where last night I had the opportunity to speak to the pastor and wives banquet of the Tampa Bay Baptist Association. After that, I had the opportunity to bring greetings to the association during its meeting, its 100th anniversary meeting. Later today, I'll be speaking at the Pastor's Luncheon, sponsored by WTBN here in Tampa Bay. I'm looking forward to being with the pastors for that event. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to spts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.